session number 20062, Reel 4.
And they were, so our NCHAPs wanted to get away back to their families and their jobs, and these Danes wanted to enjoy life. But one thing they hadn't bargained for, and I've often wondered why the British played it that way, was that they would, as it were, be, I wouldn't say fighting the Jews, but they... The Jews were, if we had an enemy, they were their enemy. They were shooting at us. They were putting mines and things about. And yet the Danes and their families had been helping Jews escape from the Nazis in Denmark for the past 4 or 5 years. So it was a bit ironic. And... I had a Danish batman, a chap called Jacobson, and I talked to him about it, and he said, well, you know, it does seem a bit odd. That isn't really what we thought we'd be doing, but there it is, and we quite like being here, and it's hot and sunny, we're not going to create. But I know that they didn't entirely enjoy the business of going after and putting these Jews in jail. And we had an escape while we were there, and a couple of Jews got out of one of these camps in the back of a laundry van, and the guards should have searched the laundry van, and the guards at the time happened to have been Danes, and I've sometimes wondered whether there was a little bit of collusion. Nobody ever proved it, nobody ever really investigated it that carefully, but it could have been. Anyway, there's a slight footnote to that one, because obviously we got hell for letting these chaps out. And all the rules about searching vehicles and stopping vehicles and all this sort of thing coming in and out of the camp were tightened up. And a few days later, the nearest military garrison was a place called Sarafand, where there was a district commander who was a sort of local administrative commander. He wasn't our direct boss. We had a divisional brigadier, obviously, but he was the local commander, and he obviously thought that he would like to see if we were doing what we should do over gate guards. And so he came up in his staff car with his flag flying, drove up to the gate of one of these camps without having told anybody he was coming. And the sentry, who was a Dane, lifted the gatepost, the barrier, and the driver drove on. And every gate was covered by a sentry with a machine gun, with a Bren gun, in a little sandbagged emplacement next to the gate. And so the chap on the with the Bren gun, and they'd all been given hell by their sergeant for letting this other thing happen, letting these chaps out in the laundry van. And so he was much more on the ball now, and he was not going to let this happen. And he'd seen that his mate had not checked the vehicle properly and that it had just driven through. And flag or no flag, he wasn't going to have it. So he put a burst of fire into the car, which luckily went through the bonnet and didn't hurt the brigadier or his driver. So we had another great blast from the brigadier. But I always felt it was his fault, that he should have stopped. And they had said, look, I may be a brigadier, but you've got to check me properly, instead of just driving through. However, that was two incidents with the Danes. And the third incident I might mention, which is a funny one, really. When we were back in Egypt, there was a certain amount of unrest in the armed forces generally. At the end of the war, the system for demobilization was you were all allotted an age and service group, and that depended A, on how old you were, and B, how long you'd been in. And each month, a number of these age and service groups came up, and that was the end of your time, off you went, out. And I suppose because of problems in Palestine and in the Far East, the Dutch East Indies, Sumatra and all that part, somebody in London decided we were running out of soldiers and we've got to stop people going out quite so fast. And so they put a six-month hold on. Well, you can imagine, that was very, very unpopular. People who thought they were going out suddenly found they weren't. And I think the RAF started this, but some of the RAF sort of took what would now be called industrial action, I suppose, i.e. they refused to work, some of the ground crew, ground staff in the RAF.
In Palestine.
I have a feeling it started in India, but certainly it then spread to Palestine. We weren't in Palestine then, we were down in Egypt. And then it spread to the administrative units in Egypt. And it started, I think, and was masterminded by Sam Breitbach in the ordnance depot at Tel El Kebir. And the first we heard of it, or I heard of it, in the middle of the night, I was asleep, and I was woken up by the orderly officer, who said, we've got to stand to and get up to port side. And I, you know, I said, why? And he said, I don't know, but we've got to go at once, and the colonel's got to report in an hour or something, somewhere or other up in port side. Well, we happened to be the internal security standby unit for port side, so we naturally assumed that there was some sort of civilian riot on, which we'd got to go and contain. And we hurriedly got ourselves together and threw a battery, a duty battery of soldiers with rifles and bayonets and ammunition into the backs of lorries and trundled up the road. And I went up, and there on the road side at a prearranged RV rendezvous was the colonel with somebody else, and looking rather worried, which he never did. He wasn't that sort of man. And he said, there's a mutiny, and we've got to sort it out. A mutiny of British troops. And he said, one of the administrative units here, I think it was a port operating company or something who were running the docks, has locked all its officers up in the NAFI. No, in the mess, in the officers' mess. Is refusing to work and has sent a deputation to the commander, the local garrison commander, saying that they won't go back to work until there's reconsideration about when they can get out and various other so-called injustices which they thought were going on. So we, and by chance, the vast majority of the soldiers who were coming up in the lorries, in our lot, were Danes. And so we then had this extraordinary position of these Danish soldiers rounding up British soldiers. And we went into this this camp where they'd mutinied, sort of swanned out round the edge, and then marched slowly in towards the centre and herded the British soldiers, who were all perfectly amenable, generally. I mean, they weren't sort of... They were grumbling, but they weren't going to cause any real trouble. We put them all in the cookhouse, in the dining hall, and locked them in there. We then let the officers out. Our colonel went into the dining hall and talked to these chaps and told them they were really making an awful fool of themselves and that he'd look into their grievances, but they simply must go back to work because they were only going to have awful trouble if they didn't, and the sooner they went back, the better. And the military police then appeared, who had been remarkably absent up to then, and the commander of the unit, a major, said, well, I think these six or whatever it was are the ringleaders, and so the military police removed the so-called ringleaders, and the rest of them went back to work. And that was that, and we went home. But the outcome, I understand, and this is slight hearsay, it was rather interesting too, that when the police took them away, for safekeeping, they put them on a ship and they put them on a ship in the middle of the Suez Canal. And a QC, which I think, and this again is hearsay, was a man called D.N. Pritt, who was a socialist, came out to defend them in the court-martial. And he apparently showed that it was illegal to put them on this ship because the Suez Canal is an international waterway and did not come within the judicial authority of the British commander. And therefore, there was a legal fault in the procedure, and therefore, they'd got to be let off. And they were let off, and which probably was a very good thing, because it wouldn't have done anybody a lot of good, I don't think, in a way, if it had got a lot of publicity. And I've never heard, and I never saw anything in the papers about it at all. It's presumably all recorded somewhere. Anyway, that was an interesting incident, which the Danes, I think, by then, were so sort of inured to the peculiarities of the British Army that the fact that they'd been locking up Jews on one hand and British soldiers on another didn't really worry them.
Which year was this?
This must have been in 46, I would think. It could have just been in 47, but I would think it was 46, guess-wise.
So it sounds as though these were sappers, were they?
They were really civilians, I would say, who were probably mostly recruited from the dockers communities, Liverpool or London or wherever, or even Hull, into the sappers. But they were not sappers in the sort of normal meaning of the term. They were specialist units. And our impression was that having met their officers when we let them out, we weren't really entirely surprised that they'd refused to work, because I don't think they'd been... I mean, we had taken enormous trouble over this business of this hold of 6 months in the demobilization. We'd taken great trouble to see if there were any really compassionate cases, or if it was going to cause real hardship, to see if one couldn't get round it in some way or other. And I don't think any combat unit had any trouble at all. I think this mutiny was controlled entirely, was kept entirely to a few administrative units. It didn't spread at all, as far as the army was concerned. But it's an unusual affair, which I haven't heard much mention of. Of course, thinking of this incident of the so-called mutiny at Port Said, in May 44, when we were getting ready for the invasion, I'd said we had to load our ship at Tilbury. And, of course, the trucks which pulled our guns, they were great big things we call matadors, heavy tractors. And the shells and cartridges for the guns were in them when they were loaded, because obviously when we offloaded onto the landing craft and went ashore, we had to bring our ammunition with us. And so they always had the ammunition in the lorries. So when we drove down to the docks to load these a few days before we embarked, It was a matter of getting the guns into the ship, onto the ship, and the tractors. And the dockers stopped work, which amazed our soldiers somewhat, because they knew what they were going in for, and they couldn't see where the bloody dockers were being so difficult. And the dockers said, look, these vehicles have got petrol in, shells in, and if anybody makes a mistake or drops a cigarette, we could have one hell of an explosion, and we want danger money. And I thought then that was quite a sort of interesting point, that here were the soldiers going off on their whatever meager pay they got to fight the Germans, and here were these damn dockers asking for danger money merely for loading the trucks into the ship. And I think, again, these would have been the same type of man who caused the problems in Port Said those years later. And they were a very militant bunch and went on being so, of course, which did so much damage to the docks trade over the years.
So I understand it that in Palestine, your artillerymen were really acting in an infantry role.
Yes, entirely. We did the odd exercise with the guns in the desert now and then, but we were absolutely doing that. And it was quite interesting. The Jews were a crafty bunch. I personally had admiration for them in one way, in that one saw how much they were doing in the settlements around Galilee, for example, in the way of agriculture, compared with the Arab, who merely, generally speaking, lets his goat eat all the trees and bushes and doesn't exactly improve the land. But it had been his land for centuries, and so one very much saw both sides of the argument. And the wretched Jews, of course, we also saw them coming ashore. We occasionally had to meet these ships, which they'd at the end of the war, when the camps were emptied, what was left of them from these concentration camps, their one thought was to get away, and various legal and semi-legal organizations rented terrible old rust buckets of ships in Holland and Egypt, in Greece and so on, and overloaded them, and off they came to try and get into Palestine. And of course there was a quota of numbers which the government tried to stick to, and Ernie Bevin, I think, in particular, wasn't particularly sympathetic to the Jewish cause. And the ships came over there, and the Navy tried to intercept them. And there were some rather nasty incidents with boarding these ships. And occasionally one got through the blockade and beached itself. And if it beached, we then had to meet it gather up the passengers as they scrambled ashore, take them up to one of these, either to usually to Haifa, and where they were put on another ship and taken off to Cyprus. It was an odd thing to have to do, but if we hadn't kept some sort of control of the immigration, we would have had even more trouble. And I think then when they got to Cyprus, of course, in the end, they all eventually got back again into Palestine. One ship was actually, I can't remember the name of it, but there was a fearful international sort of uproar because the British government sent one ship all the way back to Hamburg. And that really did create a fairly unpleasant row, and I don't think that was tried again. And from then on, they were put into Cyprus. But the soldiers didn't much enjoy that sort of business because there were women and children, and the Jews do set up the most fearful noise and rumpus when this sort of thing happens. Well, they did do then. They didn't always seem to have done in the old days with the Germans. But we, as you say, we were working entirely as sort of policemen and infantrymen. And then we left in, I suppose, some date in 47 and went over to Tripoli.
Was that entirely peaceful?
Oh, that was entirely peaceful, yes, entirely peaceful. There was it was British run. It was a British military government. The Italian colonies all along the whole lot, Eritrea, Somaliland, Libya, Cyrenaica, Tripolitania, all those Italian colonies which we'd captured during the war were being run by a British administration until eventually they got independence under the UN a number of years later.
So what were you supposed to be doing now?
Well, we didn't do anything, really. Is it interesting? Because I can talk about it very briefly. We were... it was rather extraordinary. I've said earlier, we were three field regiments of artillery armed with 25-pounders. And the whole division was disbanded. It was reformed a few years later, but it was disbanded in Palestine. And the gunners were sent to Tripoli, where we became three anti-aircraft regiments, literally overnight, knowing absolutely nothing about anti-aircraft. And we were given anti-aircraft guns, and there was really no need for anti-aircraft regiments anyway, and certainly not in Tripoli. So it was merely waiting for the army to get smaller. And I think at that particular point, as Palestine was being given up, there was no need for much. The army in the Middle East was being run down, and this was part of the rundown. And we had a very happy time. In fact, my wife's father was one of the administrators. He'd come up from Sudan, where he was in the Sudan political service, and he'd come up to govern a bit of it, of these Italian colonies, and she'd come out from England to stay with her parents. And I met her there. So we got engaged while I was out there. And we did very little except sail and shoot occasionally, grouse and sand grouse and partridges and duck, and generally enjoy ourselves and do a very small amount of training once we learned how to operate these anti-aircraft guns. And then the regiments were being run down all the time, and the one I was in was eventually disbanded. I don't think I've very much more I can say about life in Tripoli. We were helping sort of administer the country up to a point, but only in a very minor way.
Now, if we can jump ahead to the mid-60s, you had a spell in Aden, please.
Yes.
In what capacity?
Well, I'd from 48, I left Tripoli, came back and got married in England. And then from 48 till 65, I was in the army either in England or Germany, in various jobs, regimental and staff jobs, including spells at the Staff College and School of Artillery and so on. Most of it in Germany. Then in 1965, I was appointed to command 1st Regiment Royal Horse Artillery. And as I took over, we were literally on our way to Aden for 2 years with our families as an accompanied regiment. At that time, in 65, there hadn't been any discussion that we were going to give up Aden, and otherwise I'm sure we wouldn't have taken our families with us. So from our point of view, my point of view, it was a jolly good thing we didn't know. The regiment came back from Germany, where it had been for 14 years, came here to Netherhaven for a very brief period of retraining on different guns, and sort of getting itself sorted out for active service, which it, again, hadn't had since the war. And I took it out in September 65 to Aden, and where we found ourselves to be the supporting regiment for the upcountry. Aden is divided, or was then divided, into sort of two bits. There was the old Aden colony, which is Aden City, plus a coastal strip round it with the oil refinery and all that goes with the oil refinery, big BP set up there, and an urban population. And then you go a number of miles inland and you hit almost an escarpment. The hills begin going very high, up to 6,000 feet and higher. Totally different countryside. The coastal strip is rather barren, dusty, dry, and you then get up in the hills where it's greener, there is water, there are trees, a certain amount of agriculture. Tribal, very tribal, very medieval. All the tribesmen carrying rifles, a lot of blood feuds, etc., and that sort of thing, administered by a very, very few British political officers. And with a local army, a locally enlisted Arab army, which used to be called the Aden Levies and then was called the Federal Regular Army, the FRA, and it consisted of 5 or 6 infantry battalions with no guns. And the guns were provided and the air support was provided by the British, and we were the guns. And we were spread along a distance of many hundreds of miles along the border of the Aden territory, the Federated Territory of Saudi Arabia, and the Yemen proper, which was to the north, which was slowly becoming a sort of subordinate state to a great extent of Egypt. And Egypt was then dominated by Nasser and very anti-British following the Suez Canal fiasco. And he was supplying them with arms and mines, mostly British, and they were generally raising hell along the border and occasionally raising hell within the border in the mountains. And in 63-64, there had been quite a considerable little campaign called the Radfan campaign in the mountains of the interior, some 50 to 100 miles north of Aden. And this had died down, and the dissidents, as they were called, had slowly sort of given up being quite so tricky. But the mining and sniping and general nastiness went on to a greater or lesser extent all the time, and through 65 and into 66 and right on till 67 when we left. And in 67, as you know, we pulled out of Aden towards the end of 67 and gave up, which was politically, of course, a disgrace, to the extent that we had promised the upcountry rulers of these states that we would not do that, that we would support them, and we broke all those treaties. But the government at the time decided that Aden was of no strategic value any longer, it wasn't worth British lives maintaining our base there. So we gave up. And it was probably one of the worst episodes, I would say, in the our decline, in our departure from empire, in that it was a piddling little place, and that had there been the political will to have got a grip of the security situation, it could have been done. But there wasn't the political will, and so everything rather disintegrated. And there were some nasty episodes towards the end, which you may remember over. Remember the story of the Argylls and Colin Mitchell and that, right at the very end, and the Aden army mutinied, the Arab army. We went out in a very unhappy way. My own regiment had gone by then. We had a very...